Let's go back to I don't know where does this notion of cool kids versus nerds begin? Does it go all the way back to Adams Jefferson?
Well, I was actually looking at it when I was thinking about it. I was looking at it in the present because so many of the culture wars that we're seeing are playing out in a way that always looks to me like something between fifth grade and high school, senior and high school. And if you think about the fact that you have people like the MAGA wing of the Trump Republicans really focusing on the idea that, it's not cool to go to school, it's not cool to know stuff really well, it is cool to sort of be a party animal and all that. I feel like what we're seeing is sort of those guys in high school taking over our politics. But what's so interesting about that right now is you've got the Department of Government Efficiency guys, the tech bros, people like Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, actively attacking that cool kid thing. And, somebody wrote, which I thought was really interesting, that so many of those MAGA types really grew up with people like Trump lionizing the idea that, you don't need an education, you don't need to do anything but sort of be super masculine or super feminine, and you're going to be great. And then you got Vivek Ramaswamy going, well, actually, the culture of the prom queen and the football player and all that is going to get you absolutely nowhere. And we got to have more people, studying and having tutors and going to math, competitions. And that whole sort of cultural dynamic in the present moment, just really strikes me as going all the way back, at least in the modern era, to Reagan, who had very deliberately talked about, how look at him, he could be a C student from, where was it? Elmira College he went to.
I think so.
It
Yeah.
was a small college
In the
in
Midwest,
California.
right? Or
Or
Eureka
maybe it was in the
College.
Midwest.
Is it
Eureka, that
Eureka?
was it.
Yeah.
And he kept saying, I'm just a C student from Eureka College, and I'm not like one of those Harvard guys. And it worked. But now we've sort of seen it come out to what almost is like a bad afternoon movie.
But even though Nixon maybe would have been more of a nerd than a cool kid, but he always felt that he only had that Whittier College education, and although I think he went to Duke Law School, but always had some envy and a little bit of jealousy for the Ivy League guys.
Yes, and it's really Reagan who weaponizes that. And he used to take pot shots at Harvard all the time. But that even goes back a step before to the whole concept of this Eastern establishment that had in 1952 turned the Republican nomination away from their golden child in the Republican Party, on the right wing of the Republican Party, Senator Robert Taft from Ohio, who was the son of William Howard Taft, the president. And the expectation in 52 among Taft and his followers was that he was going to get the nomination and he was going to undo everything that FDR had done. And it was Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. in Massachusetts, who managed to turn the Republican nomination away from Taft and toward Eisenhower. And that's when we get this idea of the Eastern establishment, the eggheads who are ruining true America. But it goes back even further than that. I mean, there is a cultural trope there that, you can take all the way back to the colonial era and the evangelical fights over the colonial ministers who were monopolizing society on the more settled eastern parts of the North American continent. And the people who moved out to the West and didn't have access to education and didn't have access to the courts and didn't have access to the kinds of economies that would enable them to rise up simply said, well, we're better than you because we have a better relationship with God than you do.
And we saw that fight, I think it was in the 1824 election, when you had Jackson viewed as this wild man from the wilderness running against John Quincy Adams, made a claim that others have made since, that the election was stolen from him and with a little evidence to back it up as well, but then became that first real big populist guy when he was elected in 1828 and rode that to 2 terms and tremendous popularity.
Yeah, and that's And I'm thinking about this. I sort of threw out when we were talking about stuff we could talk about the idea of the nerds versus the cool kids, but because in this moment, I really do see it playing out over the kind of language that you see in sort of high school and high school movies, really since the 1970s or the 1980s. But that idea of a conflict in the United States between people who have educations and qualifications and access to resources and often are from more settled societies where they have had more opportunities versus those who at least pretend they are not that way has been a constant in our politics really since Jackson. I mean, you get the log cabin campaign of William Henry Harrison, and then you've got Lincoln being called a log cabin candidate when that man couldn't get out of a log cabin fast enough to make him happy. He so hated the idea of manual labor. So that idea of being of the people is really deeply rooted in our democracy. But the trick was for people like Lincoln and perhaps even Harrison and certainly Jackson is that it was more image than reality. They sort of had an idea of what they were doing.
Now, in the real modern era, the last couple of decades, certainly George W. Bush would be an example of that, although he was the bluest of blue bloods by birthright. And yet, I remember at the time people saying, well, I mean, maybe he doesn't have a great grasp of the issues, but I feel like I could have a beer with that guy.
Well, and that was well, when I said that people, certainly people like Jackson played that up, played the image and knew what was going on. I mean, it's important to remember, I think, that Jackson wins in large part because of the machinations of Martin Van Buren in New York. I mean, that's really almost a New York-centered victory for Andrew Jackson. And certainly the same is true of George W. Bush, where, here's a personal story. I once did an interview or something where I referred to the fact that he had gone to Yale and had been a cheerleader on the Yale cheerleading team, which is true. I mean, that happened. You would not believe the angry mails I got. This is absolutely not true. He's from Texas. He's a cowboy. He cuts brush down here. And I'm thinking, listen, he certainly did that, which is something that I had talked about. But and I wasn't, it wasn't a, certainly not a slur. I simply said, he's from Connecticut. He went to Yale and he was on the cheerleading team. And you would have
Grandson of
thought,
Prescott Bush, for crying out loud.
that's right. That's right. So that division, the idea that in order to represent the American people, you have to sort of be a cowboy, if you will, I think runs through our politics.
And you've written about this and talked about it a lot, and it's that whole idea that going back to Reagan, that he really popularized, but Goldwater played a role in it back in 1964 as well. And it's the myth of the rugged, independent Westerner who was always victimized by the government in Washington.
Yes, and while that certainly goes back to the cowboy imagery from the immediate post-Civil War years, where it was deliberately used to stand against the idea of a government that would protect equal rights for Black Americans in the South, that strand, I think, goes all the way back through the concept of, a yeoman farmer in the early days of the American Republic, and back to this idea that if you're of the land, you are somehow superior to those people who are educated and who are working in some kind of an office building. I teach a course on the American cowboy, and one of the things that I start the course with is I have the students read Flint by Louis L'Amour, which is, a perfect Western novel. It is a perfect Western novel. And the question that I ask them to deal with is, in a fight between James Bond and Flint, who would win? Because there you have it, right? James Bond, who represents Europe, of course, or England, has all the gadgets and all the education and all the toys and all the support, and he's got teams and he's got cars and he's got. On the other hand, you got Flint, and who's going to win? And people get quite hot under the collar about that.
Well, I'm sure they do. Somebody like a Bill Clinton, how does he fit into this? Because he was, in many ways, a cool kid, but also that policy wonk deep down inside.
Well, so this is, I think, really interesting because as we're playing with this idea, one of the things that jumps out to me about, recently Jimmy Carter has passed, and certainly Bill Clinton, and now the outgoing president, Joe Biden. All three of those presidents, and certainly you could throw in Barack Obama about that, but I think he's slightly different, and I'll explain why in a second. All three of those presidents were people who worked their way up from disadvantaged backgrounds into positions of extraordinary education and ability. And the reason that I think that that maybe plays into what we're talking about today is that I don't think any one of those three people was well treated by the media. And if you think about the media as being the cool kids, you can see they always kept those people at arm's length. Now, the person that is not like that, I think, is Barack Obama, who also worked his way up from a disadvantaged background, but who in some ways was a media darling because he became one of the cool kids.
It's interesting, but it makes perfect sense when you frame it that way. I think it was David Brooks, the New York Times, though I don't often agree with, but he made some interesting points after the election about this notion that there's a segment of the American population that feels left out, left behind by the economy of the 21st century, and that they blame those in higher education for doing that. Those who got the advanced degrees were the people who became the CEOs of the company that then outsourced the work that cost them their jobs in the industrial world. And that maybe there's some justification for some of this anger that they supposedly expressed at the ballot box.
Well, this is actually a concept near and dear to my heart because it frustrates me to no end. In fact, the American middle class has been hollowed out since 1981. We know that about $50 trillion moved from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1% of Americans between 1981 and 2021. You know, the same time that you were hearing so much about how the reason that there were problems in the country's economy were because the people who were racial, ethnic, or religious minorities were sucking tax dollars, that money was actually going straight up to the 1%. So I think you're right that that's what people identify. But I think it's really important to understand that that was a deliberate rhetorical strategy used during the Nixon administration by one of his speechwriters, who was also a speechwriter for Barry Goldwater, by the way, and that was Pat Buchanan, in
Right.
which he talked about the need to create this idea that the Republican voters who were loyal to Nixon, who were at that point starting to slide away from him because of Kent State, because what the way they handled Kent State in May of 1970 really upset a lot of Nixon's middle class voters, especially male voters who had sent their kids off to college and are watching, you know, them die. They recognized that in order to continue to get people to vote for Nixon, they had to engage in what they called positive polarization. Positive because it would bring voters to the Republicans, which they thought was a positive thing. And one of the keys to doing that was to talk about those Eastern establishment people, those eggheads, those people who were rather like Adlai Stevenson, for
Yes.
example, in the Democratic side, who was brought into the Democratic Party in part because it was seen as being a working man's party. And this was a way to try and increase its reach outside of that FDR base. And so I think that when people like Brooks identify that there is real reason for anger, I agree that there is real reason for anger. What I don't agree with is the idea that the people to blame for it are the people in the academy, which doesn't have a lot of weight, you know, in the real world, in many cases, but that what you're really looking at is a political attempt to weaponize this cultural thing you and I are playing with to convince people to vote against their own interests, which is what's happened between 81 and 2021 for that particular group of people.
We're talking with Heather Cox Richardson here on Downtown. So how is Trump, who I'm guessing has never been through a checkout line at a supermarket in his life, that has a golden toilet and has lived that life, how has he been able to successfully frame himself as someone who is a cool kid who understands the struggles of the regular working class person?
Well, isn't that interesting? I mean, one of the things that is so fascinating about Trump, and I mean, I just want to say I am appalled that he will be at the head of our government, because of the way I care, in which I care about the mechanics of our government and so on. That being said, it's a mistake to dismiss him as not very good at what he does. He's a performer. He performs things. And one of the things that he has performed phenomenally well, and one of the reasons I started thinking about this cool kid thing, is he essentially has turned American politics into professional wrestling. And he presents himself as the cool guy. He's the winner. He's the guy who puts the nerd in the closet and or in the locker or whatever one does. And what is really interesting about that is that builds on what you and I were talking about, the idea of real strength from the people who don't have educations, who don't have access to the cities, who don't, you know, and you know, you and I are both from Maine. We get that's not fake. You know, my husband didn't go to college. I think this is just in societies where you don't have those social markers, you know, it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't really matter if you go to college or not. But he managed to take that idea of the heartland and turn it into the winning professional wrestler. And that was no small accomplishment, if you think about it. And I think it was quite deliberate the way he did it.
Well, whatever skills he has, one of them is certainly the ability to read the audience and understand which way the wind is blowing. And he's been doing that certainly since 2015, and no sign that it's going to stop anytime soon. Well, it's a fascinating conversation and a nice way to look at the world.
But you know, if you think about that, again, one of the things that my students and I talked about when he was starting to make a mark on politics was, is he a cowboy? Because the winning formula in American politics after 1981 was you had to be a cowboy. You know, they remember George W. Bush went and bought the farm of, you know, the Brush Farm and all that, and, you know, kept showing up in cowboy hats. And you had Rush Limbaugh writing about how, you know, white hats for cowboys are my guys, and, you know, that very famous essay. And, you know, the idea you had in American Olympic teams wore cowboy clothing. And there was this idea you had to be an American cowboy. And so, how did Trump assume those qualities? While living in a penthouse in New York
He's an
with,
urban cowboy, Heather.
oh my Lord, I never thought of that. What a great way to think about it.
He's something, all right. Well, before we let you go, though, I want to get on to a much more pleasant subject in terms of what he meant to both of us and what he gave to the people who enjoyed his work for so many years, but great sadness as well. We lost a terrific friend and a wonderful legend from the state of Maine recently. Can you talk about the impact of the great David Mallett on your life?
Probably not without crying, to be honest. But David Mallett, for people who don't know, everybody knows him as a songwriter who wrote the song, which has been covered and turned into children's books, and you know, covered by everyone and turned into children's books. But he was a brilliant writer. He was a brilliant, brilliant songwriter, and his use of words created images. So for people who are studying words and the way they use them, you couldn't do better than David Mallett. So we'll start there with lines like, I can't even start with some. I was thinking of the line about the old pool where the fish wait for the old fool
Old
with the
pull
wrong
for the
bait.
wrong bait. Oh my, it's my favorite of his songs.
I mean, there's just not a bad one. So in terms of his artistry, I mean, you can start there. But you know, for me, the very first musical concert I went to was David Mallett with my brother in, he was just starting out. It was just after his first album came out. So what would that have been?
77,
70,
78, something like that. Yeah.
77,
Which
78.
I think is about the time I met him when he was promoting that first
Oh,
album.
so how did you know him? I'll tell him you more about me, but how'd you know him?
Well, because I think he had recorded his first album down in Blue Hill at Noel Paul Stuckey's studio. I was doing country radio at the time as a young, incredibly young guy. And he came up to come in the studio and do an interview and promote the album, and just had a really great conversation with him. And every time he'd come out with a new album, he would reach out and come in, and we would talk about it, and he would go into great detail. And so first met him 40 plus years ago, and then of course would go to shows like everybody else. And then I shared the story on social media. I'll give you the short version that about 25 years ago, I was working at Brewer Middle School. And we had this old 1920s era auditorium, and I wanted to turn it into a performance space for more than just students. And I thought, this would be a really wonderful intimate spot to do concerts. And I reached out to Dave. He loved the idea. We brought him in. He was horrified because we had just finished doing The Wizard of Oz with our high school and middle school actors. And at the front of the stage was a yellow brick road that was still there. And he looked at it and said, "Where the hell do I sing from?" Let's put you right on that yellow brick road. Well, then he was okay. But he said, look, I want you to make some money so you can get off to a good start with what you're trying to do. So I got to pay the band, but I'm going to work for a little less than normal to help you out. And we bought a bunch of chairs, upholstered folding chairs with the proceeds of that show. And that led to us doing, I think, a couple dozen concerts over the next several years with some pretty big names. But we always called those the Dave Mallett chairs. And now they live in the dressing room of our fairly brand new performing arts center. And so our young kids, our high school and middle school actors, sit in those chairs to put on makeup, get into costume before they take the stage. And I think that's perfect symmetry because Dave, as you know, was a theater major in college.
It's such a wonderful story, but that just utterly captures him, doesn't it?
Yeah. And we brought him back, I don't know, probably 6 or 8 times through the years, and including doing a show at our new Performing Arts Center a little over a year ago, which was, I think, the last time he performed in Brewer.
So just to sort of bring full circle that, you know, the first thing I ever heard him, the ever concert I ever heard was at the Camden Opera House with him. And last year, I spoke at the Camden Opera House and he was in the audience, which, you know, but in between those two things, his music, the capturing of the kind of mind he had in song, because some obviously when you write, you're writing about the inside of your own head, and the observations of the world that I grew up in, but also that the country grew up in, the color with which he described them, the way you could see it when he described them, combined with the fact that embedded in almost everything he did, with the exception of the few songs I can think of that were about people passing, were optimistic. They had faith in ordinary Americans. I mean, which is kind of a good coda to where we started this. And that idea that no matter whether you're looking at a home burning down or, you know, trying to make it as an artist and it not going the way you want it to, or a failed relationship, or a child being born, or, you know, an absolutely beautiful sunset, or being the old fool with the wrong bait is, I think when I recognized that, I realized, I always said he provided the soundtrack to my life, which he did, but I also think he provided that undercurrent of optimism in the American people, no matter what they faced. And, you know, it's just such a loss to lose him. I will add, for people who don't know them, his sons are also an excellent band that I see whenever I possibly can.
With a new album just out.
Oh, was it the whole album? I thought it was just a song that dropped.
I think they've got a brand new album coming out, yeah.
And they're the Mallett Brothers. And actually, they're playing in Camden, at the Camden Opera House on the 21st of March. Not that I looked it up or anything.
Oh, no. No, and I sent a message to Dave at the Democratic Convention when they played a song each time the states announced their delegate counts at the Democratic Convention. And I said, I don't know what song that was they played for Maine, Dave, but it should have been your song, Celebration.
Yeah. No, and there were a lot of us, if you don't know the song Celebration, it's worth listening to, which he wrote, I believe, in 2016.
Think so.
A lot of us had thought they really should be using that much more heavily than they were. I posted it a lot around the time of the election because it's a great anthem for America. It's maybe not what younger people are wrapping their heads around these days, but it's David is best.
Absolutely. Well, Heather, it is great to talk with you as always. Thank you so much for being here on the very first episode of the brand new podcast. And we wish you well and look forward to reading tomorrow morning's newsletter. And we'll check in with you again down the road sometime soon.
I hope. I hope you do. I hope you make me a regular, Rich. I gotta say that you are. I always hate to use the superlative because then you make other people angry. But you are at least one of the very, very best interviewers in this whole country, which is why when I knew you were launching out on your own, I wrote you instantly and said anything, anytime. So I wish you real luck in this venture.
It's much appreciated. Always wonderful to talk with you. Thank you, Heather. Be well.
You too.